I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, who will speak until 10:10, and if time permits, we'll answer any questions from the audience. Let's all welcome my dear buddy, Dwight from Cyprus. God bless you, man.
Hi, everybody. My name is Dwight Heitman. I'm a very grateful sober alcoholic. I'm, thanks to the grace of God, the love in these rooms, and the work in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had to found it necessary to take a drink since the 4th of July, 1991. Works out to 7,820 days today, one day at a time. And for that, I'm very grateful because it runs contrary and counter to the way that I grew up living my life. I got the classic story you've heard over and over in Alcoholics Anonymous. I come from a dysfunctional family. It's dysfunctional because I'm a member of the family. Everybody else, I've got two younger sisters, and they're well adjusted and grown up and got families and taking care of business. And my parents have been married for 56 years now. They're still with us and still kicking and still active. And then there's me, the guy that never could quite put his finger on what was wrong, but something was always wrong. There was something about just about everything that it was just slightly askew, and I was a little bit uncomfortable, and I didn't understand it. I didn't understand this little ball of which I've identified lately as fear, that was there the whole time. Fear of interacting with people and new situations and all of that kind of stuff. That was just kind of how I grew up. I grew up over on the west side, over in Garden Grove, and went to school there, my dad owned a piece of construction equipment, heavy equipment, and on the weekends and in the summertime, he'd get me up at 5 o'clock in the morning and say, "Come on, I'm going to teach you a trade. This is my dad's one of those old school guys. He's not going to hug you, he's not going to tell you he loves you, but to show you he loves you, he's going to, teach you how to take care of yourself." And this is how he was going to, teach me. He says, "We're going to learn a trade. You're going to learn how to run this backhoe. You're going to dig ditches. It's be something to fall back on if it all falls apart for you." And I said, "That's the last thing in the world I want to do. I don't want to be a backhoe operator, Dad. I don't want to do that." And dragging me out of bed at 4:30 in the morning, I hated that guy, man. I hated that guy for a long, long time. I don't want to do that. I'm going to be a rock and roll star. That's what I'm going to do. And, it was the perfect thing for me because I could lock myself up in my room and practice real hard until I got it just right and then bring it out and show it to people. I didn't have to make my mistakes out in public. That was one of my great fears is looking stupid in public. There's nothing worse than that one. And so guitar was perfect for me because I could learn it in my room and then take it out, once I had it ready and that kind of thing. Today I'm not a rock and roll star. Today I'm a backhoe operator. That's how it worked, and the old man was a pretty smart guy after all, thanks to the miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, he and I have a wonderful relationship today. I was able to make my amends to him a long, long time ago, and we sit next to each other in my son's basketball games. In the gyms. I'm a little hoarse, actually. I was wondering how it was going to work today because I was shouting words of encouragement to the referees last night. And I know they just want to get things right. I understand that, and I want to help, once again, the program's helped me with that because I no longer follow them out to the parking lot. I am content to let them do their thing once it's over. But I was talking about that feeling of being uncomfortable, that feeling of being afraid, and that was something I had with me forever until I discovered alcohol. I discovered drugs and alcohol at an early age. At 13, I started my pre-AA training, and man, it all went away. It was at first at first I couldn't hold it down. You know, I drank a couple of those tall cans of Schlitz malt liquor, and man, right back up again, you know. But the first time I held a couple of cans of beer down, I saw what the fuss was about. You know, I saw why people would, do the stupid things they do when they have too much to drink, man. I saw what the big fuss about was, because, man, when I took a drink of alcohol, my whole attitude and outlook upon life changed, you know. When I took a drink of alcohol, fear of people and economic insecurity left me. I realized that alcohol was doing for me what I couldn't possibly do for myself. And, man, it was wonderful. And, forgot your name, the Taylor Swift fan here with us, was talking about, you know, having a 90% great guy and 10% ass, right? That was, in my mind, that's the way it was for me, too. I think it was really closer to 98.8 ass, you know, and occasionally I could be a nice guy. I was an angry drunk. I would black out. And I would, basically I'd get into fights I couldn't win, and I'd wreck cars I didn't own, and I'd get tossed out of places that normal people wouldn't have walked into in the first place, you know, and get banned, you know, and that was my drinking career. By the time I hit 22, I had alienated, you know, I'd burned a lot of bridges and alienated a lot of people. I was working towards that rock and roll star status thing. At the time, I was playing in a band. We were playing five nights a week, and it was a bad environment for me, playing in bars, you know, from 9 till 2 in the morning, and I was an absolute mess. And I came to out of a blackout, and looked at the house I was sharing with another couple and my girlfriend, and it was destroyed from the inside out, and I knew that it was me that had done it, you know. And I looked down here, and I'm covered in blood, and it's probably all mine. And but I don't remember anything, so I start making phone calls, and nobody will take my phone calls, and I'm scared to death. So I do what all tough guys do when they get up against it. I called my mom, and I said, "Mom, help! What am I going to do?" And I went over there and saw her. I don't know what to do. What do I do? And she suggested Alcoholics Anonymous, and that seemed a little extreme to me at age 22. So I chose the easier, softer way. I don't know if any of you guys remember the Schick Center for the Control of Drug and Alcohol. I went and talked to the Schick Center counselor, and she sat me down, and she laid the whole thing out, aversion therapy. We're going to fix you right up, a 10-day stay, a couple of two-day hospital follow-ups. You're right as rain. And you'll be cured from alcoholism for the rest of your life, you know. And it's just a wonderful deal we've got here. But the sticking point for me was that 10-day hospital stay. You know, I said, I'm in a band right now. We're playing five nights a week. They're looking for a reason to fire me because I'm such a jerk. And this would be the perfect reason. So I here's what I'm prepared to do for you. I'll come in. I'll do whatever you ask me to do. Aversion therapy, I guess that's. I never actually went through it, but I guess aversion therapy is where you just drink so darn much of the stuff you can't stand it, right? I've been working on that for 5 years, but they assured me that was what was going to fix me. So I said, okay, I'm going to do what you ask me to do, whatever you want to do, and then you're going to let me out at 9. I'll go play with the band. I won't drink. I won't touch anything while I'm there, you know. And when the bar closes at 1:30 or whatever, I'll come back. You know, you let me back in. And she says, no, 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 it doesn't work that way. And I say, no, 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 you don't understand. My case is different. And for, you know, you guys have been around for Alcoholics Anonymous for a little while. You know, how often have you heard somebody, if you're working with them, you know, if you're showing them the work in the book, or just that you hear them say, no, 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 you don't understand, my case is different. And that's, you know, I was singing the Alcoholics National Anthem to her, and I didn't even know what it was. But she says to me, listen, young man, what's happened here is that you've hit bottom. And once you feel better, you'll drink again, because you're an alcoholic. And I was 22, and I was offended deeply by this woman. You know, how dare you call me an alcoholic? I mean, I've been called lots of things up to that point, you know, and you know, a bum, a lush, a drunk, and an asshole, you know, just all these terrible things. But never once had anybody ever called me an alcoholic, and I was deeply offended. And I showed her, I got up out of there and I walked out. And I didn't take another drink again for 25 months. I went and bought a bag of weed and a bag of pills and a bag of Coke and and a bag of, this, that, and the other. A bag of essentials for a wedding, I would think, is, you know, what I had going on, or at least a bag of essentials for the honeymoon. You know, I had a bag of all kinds of stuff. And I didn't take that drink for 25 months. During that time, you know, I was working towards what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a musician. That's what I wanted to do. And it wasn't working for me here. You know, we were playing the clubs and that, and we were, you know, fairly popular. We were having a great time doing it. We were playing in L.A., but we figured out, a friend of mine and I figured out that if this, we were going to really make this work for us, we were going to have to either go to New York or England, because that's London, that was where it was going on. So we flipped a coin, it came up London, we gathered up our stuff, and we got over there. And, you know, we started playing in the clubs, and we started having a good time in that, and I met my higher power while I was over there. And she convinced me that that area in California where I was drinking that was the problem, you know. And it was what I was drinking, you know. And it was the people I was drinking with. And besides, you haven't had a drink in 25 months now, you know. You're older, you're wiser, you're more well-adjusted. But she didn't. I kind of overshot the mark on that one. But she convinced me that you can't leave this island without trying our beer, because it's, you know, it's the greatest beer in the world. And she convinced me that, yeah, you know what, you're right. That's, yeah, all of those things are right. You know, it's the people I was drinking with. It was the stuff I was drinking. It was all everything but the actual booze. So I took a drink, and 2 weeks later she says to me, Dwight, you got to stop drinking, because you can't handle it, because you're an alcoholic. And that's how... Really, that's how the next 10 years of my life went, was drinking so much I couldn't stand myself, and then staying sober until I couldn't stand myself. And, you know, back and forth and back and forth with that. Not realizing, really, I there were so many things I didn't realize until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous about myself, you know, that I have since learned, you know, and I thank God for the program. I thank God for strong sponsorship. Red, thank you so much for everything. I didn't really have a drinking problem. What I had was a thinking problem. And alcohol was the solution to that thinking problem. For me, it was a solution to my living inadequacies. I could face life fearlessly when I get a couple drinks in me. And the trouble was, is I'd always overshoot that mark. I figured out at one point that 0.14 blood alcohol contact is perfect for this guy. That was we got the breathalyzer and we figured it all out, and a scientific approach to this thing. 0.14 was perfect for this guy right here. I could face traffic with confidence. I could do my job better. I dealt better with the with everything. And my trouble was I could never. I would see 0.14 in the rearview mirror as I was flying towards yet another blackout, you know. So I would try all the things in chapter 3 that we try, you know. I'd do all the negotiating. I spent those next 10 years negotiating the terms of my surrender. My wife from England came here with me, and we pulled the geographic, and unfortunately we packed all our problems first. And so we pulled another geographic and went back. And damn if we didn't do the same darn thing, you know. I pack my alcoholism first every time I go to run. And so we came back here again one more time. And as a result of consequences involved with our lifestyle, my wife died at the age of 28. You know, the death certificate will tell you it was blunt force trauma, but what it was is alcoholism. You know, this disease, you know, took her in the prime of her life. And I spent the next 3 years attempting to commit suicide on the installment plan. And, you know, cursing myself as a weakling because I couldn't just get a gun and put it to my head and end everybody's misery. And that's how I found Red. Actually, I've known Red forever. I've known Red forever. He got me out of some scrapes. I was charged with inciting a riot in Riverside in 1979, and Red got me out of that, thank goodness, among a couple of other scrapes that that he's helped me out of over the years. But I went to see him over something, an unrelated thing, and I will never forget this to my dying day, is that I sat in there and I was telling him, I hadn't seen him for a while, and he'd been sober 4 years. He said, I've been sober 4 years in AA, and I said, yeah, that's great. You know, I'm not drinking. You know, I'm on the wagon. I don't miss it. You know, I feel better. I work better. I'm having a better time. And, you know, not realizing I'm quoting the big book to him, and I don't even know there is a big book at this point. But he gives me that look, you know. He said that, he gives me that look. He not only do I know that you're full of it, but I know that you know that I know that you're full of it. So if you would continue to go down this road, feel free. But, you know, but we both know, you know, what's really at the bottom. He gave me his card. He said, when you're ready for a meeting, you call me. And a couple months later, I called him, and he took me over to the rush hour at Newport and Dodge, when it was at Newport and Dodge. I don't know where it is now, but and I don't remember anything about that meeting, except that before we walked in, he said, "Listen, you know, you're going to hear a lot of stuff, you're going to see a lot of things, you're going to, you know, focus on the similarities, and leave the differences aside." And it's the best advice I ever got in AA. It's the advice I give all the new guys that I work with now, is focus on those similarities and leave the differences aside. And then when we left the meeting, he bought me a book, said, take this home and read this book and see if you can find yourself in the pages of it. And so I did. You know, I went home and I read it, and there I was with tears in my eyes, because I found myself. You know, here was a book that was published 20 years before I was born. It was like they'd been following me around, you know, and you know, watching my every last movement, and it was so moving. It was incredible. While I'm in the midst of reading this book, Red's little brother Kent calls me up. He goes, "Hey, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm reading this amazing book. I can't believe it." He says, "Well, bring it over, man. The dope man just left." And so we sat up all night and smoked crack and read the big book really fast. and thus began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was on marijuana maintenance every day, and on the weekends I was smoking, we call it Freebase. You know, when we invented it back in 1979, we called it Freebase. So you newer guys, you're welcome, you know, for But that's how it began for me, and then I started. I realized that I wasn't going to stay sober. I mean, I wasn't sober, you know. I was on marijuana maintenance, but I would end up drinking again if I didn't get off of everything. But I didn't want to share what I had been up to, you know, because it seemed like a you know. Nobody else's business, right? This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't talk about those other outside influences, right? You know, we don't talk about outside issues like crack cocaine. And I kept it to myself. 4th of July, 1991, I had a little bowl full of marijuana. I was all by myself. I was miserable. I was going to two meetings, sometimes three meetings a week. And it wasn't working for me. And I couldn't understand why. But so anyway, I smoked this little thing, you know, all by myself, and I asked God, as I then understood God, what I should do, and God hid my pot from me. So I took that as a sign from above, you know, because when I went to look in the little area, it wasn't there anymore. So that was a sign that I'm not supposed to. Sober, you know, we use that acronym SOBER, son of a bitch, everything's real. And So that's what, from that day forward, I didn't drink. But of course, I wanted to keep those extra 70 days, right, that I hadn't had a drink. So my keen, cunning, baffling, powerful, analytical, alcoholic mind devised this thing where I could come into a meeting and I could say, I haven't had a drink since April, and I'm clean and sober today. And, you know, that was, yeah. And it got harder to share. It's funny, you know, because it got harder to raise my hand, physically harder to raise my hand. And then it got harder to go into meetings. And because I had a secret. I had a secret that I couldn't share with you guys. I had a portion of my life that I could not share with you. It was embarrassing. And it was shameful. And So, you know, my head tells me, it gives me the perfect solution. Well, why don't you just go drink, and then you'll have an honest sobriety date? You know, what a great idea. You know, what a great idea. Because the end result of doing the best up to this point, now I'm 32 years old by this time, doing the very best I can from 13 to 32, the end result of following my line of thinking was drunk and sick and in a whole bunch of trouble. No matter where I was, which part of the world I found myself in, which line of work, which relationships, the end result was always the same. It always boiled down to drunk and sick and in a whole bunch of trouble one more time. And so instead of drinking, what I finally ended up doing is I decided that I just come clean with it. You know, what a concept. You know, what a concept. I'm going to tell someone the truth. I'm going to give this thing up. Man, it was a big deal to me. It was a big deal. And, Red, I hope you don't mind me. I don't know if you share it with your friends that Red is a cancer survivor. He went through some treatment back in, 1993? Was it 93 or 92? 92? Well, anyway, he's in the hospital. He's recovering. And I burst in there. Red, I gotta talk to you. I gotta tell you this. Oh, this, you know, this is terrible. I gotta talk to you. You know that I wasn't honest with you. I was on marijuana maintenance for 2 months. Like, that's a big deal. You know, it was a big deal to me. And here, you know, he's dealing with a big deal. He's dealing with something that's, you know, worthy of being called a big deal. But you know, it's all about me. It's always all about me. Like when I sat in my first meetings and they said, "Hello, newcomer. Welcome, newcomer. You're the most important person in the room." You didn't have to tell me that. I knew that. I knew instinctively I was the most important person in the room. Thank you for acknowledging that. But you know, but you know, Red. You know, he straightens me up, and he's, you know, just relax a minute. You know, it's not the end of the world. You're clean and you're sober now. When did you stop? And I told him the 5th of July was my first, you know, sober day. He said, okay, well, that's your new sobriety date. You know, cherish that sobriety date. And if you're here and you're new today, I would pass that along to you. Know what that sobriety date is, and cherish that sobriety date, man, and take care of it. You know, treat it special. That's your sobriety date, and you don't ever have to change that, and no one's ever going to change that for you. That's yours, just as long as you want to keep it. It's yours. So, and that became mine. July 5th, 1991 is my sobriety date. I haven't had a drink or a drug from that to this. What Red told me to do was go to your home group and, you know, let them know what, you know, what happened. You know, they put you in a position of trust. By that time, I'd become the secretary of this little Sunday morning men's meeting, a little stag meeting we had over in Anaheim. And they'd made me secretary, and he said, yeah, go over there and tell them, you know. And, man, there was 2 or 3 days in between that. This was a Thursday, I guess, and oh, was I scared. You know, it was just man, I'm going to have to go in, and I'm going to have to level with these guys. And it was a big deal, you know. And so I walk in here like this, carrying this big old heavy weight, you know, walk in, and I go, guys, I got something I got to share with you. I walk in with this, jeez. Let it, set it down, and they go, what, this? This is what you've been carrying around? You know, this was going to take you out? You know, and that was the end. Now let's get on to something really important. But it really opened my eyes to what goes on here. It really is true when you hear, I love the slogans, they call them cliches, but I love the slogans and the mottos in AA. And one of them, you're only as sick as your secrets, is just as true as anything. You know, you're only as sick as your secrets. And they're always bigger and badder in my mind. My secrets are deeper and darker and bigger and badder than any of yours because they're mine. You know, as soon as they even, you know, I get that down on paper, and already the power of it is going away. But then when I share them with another person, another man for me, another man in this program, who's been through that process, it takes all the power out of that stuff, you know. And I go ahead and I get right with myself. And then I work on steps 6 and 7, and I get right with the God of my understanding. And I can tell you that today, that the God of my understanding today is different than the God of my understanding in 1991. And it's not because God's changed. It's been me. It's been me. As a result of the work that we do around here, the power of the recovery process, the joy, the sheer joy of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the commitments that we take, right? The three legacies that we have, recovery, unity, and service. As a result of that, I can say that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous today, and that's as high as any of us can attain here in AA. And it's as a result of doing this stuff, you know? And then I go out and I make my amends, you know? I get right with the people around me. So as a result of doing this, I identify the problem, I've identified the solution, I've made a decision to tap into that solution, and then I begin to get right with myself, I begin to get right with God of my understanding, and then I go out and I get right with the people about me. And today I can tell you that I'm current. Thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm current. And there's nothing better than that. You know, it's just a wonderful thing. I'm glad you guys are all a part of it. You know, it's like Red says, you know, we live in the greatest country in the world, and we're sober as a result of the work we do in here. You know, I'll say one last thing and then I'll sit down. I'm convinced that I have the things that I have in my life today because I'm a member of this. I'm plugged in to this the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I can tell you truthfully, I've never had it as good as I have it right now. And that's because of the work I do in AA. I'm also just as totally convinced that if I were to unplug right now and walk away from you guys, that I probably wouldn't drink today. I might not drink next week. But I'd start listening to that little voice in my head, right? That little voice in my head that's there right now and tells me all these things that I know not to be true because I share them with you. And you point out to me they're not true. But if I didn't have you guys to share that with, I'd listen to it. And the longer I listened to it, the more it would sound like the truth. And the longer I listened to it, thinking that it sounded like the truth, it's just a matter of time before I act on it as though I were the truth, as though it were the truth. And then I'm drunk and I'm sick and I'm in a whole bunch of trouble one more time. So, you know, I think I'll stay put. Anyway, thank you so much, Red, for asking me to come down today. Thank you very much for listening and, you know, not hooting and hollering and heckling. And, you know, it's great to be alive. It's great to be sober. Thank you. All right.